Sorry about that.
Okay.
I appreciate that. Okay, I'm also going to put it up live on Facebook Live while we're doing this as well. Okay, thank you for bringing that up. Now I got to get back to our proper saving page. Hold on one second. I apologize. Okay, here we go. Everyone have the source sheet back up? Okay, so what are the sustaining thoughts that we can derive from Pesach, even though Pesach is so very different this year? So I'd like to suggest there are a few. The first is the notion of matzah and and what matzah represents. One of the symbolic understandings of matzah is that it is its simplicity. Matzah has two ingredients, flour and water. It is the most basic of the staple foods. Each year, as Pesach rolls around and we celebrate our redemption, we are invited to consider, I'd like to suggest, the best way to serve God with our true essence, with no additives. This year in particular, this idea has relevance. Many aspects of our life have been stripped away. We are hyper-concerned at this point with the most basic parts of our life. We worry about the sparsely stocked supermarkets. We are obsessed with simple yet all-important tasks of washing our hands. As we self-quarantine, we are more in touch with those closest to us, with our family members. This all represents to me the aspect of getting back to basics, which is represented by the very simple recipe of matzah. And in fact, this idea of getting back to basics is represented in a beautiful explanation of the similarities between Pesach and Shabbat mentioned by the Sfat Emet, Yehuda Aryeh Leib Alter of Ger, the Ger Rebbe. You see his years, 1847 to 1905. He starts out by noting that there are a number of parallels between Pesach and Shabbat. Pesach itself is called Shabbat in Vayikra, the book of Vayikra. And just as the Torah commands us, Zachor Vishamor, to remember and guard, when it comes to Shabbat, it also commands us to remember the day of Yitziat Mitzrayim and to guard the observance of this day. So with that piece of information in our minds, the connection, if you will, the similarities, the parallels between Shabbat and Pesach, the Ger Rebbe goes on to teach a very important lesson. And we're going to begin on the third line of his text. I don't know if you could see my arrow on the screen. Can you see my arrow on the screen? Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
So right where my arrow is, the Ger Rebbe says as follows. Ki zechira hi nikuda pinimit she'ein ba shechacha. Zechira, the Ger Rebbe says, is not talking here specifically about the act of remembering, but to the part of our soul within each of us that is who we truly are. Zechira is always remembered. Our essence is always remembered. So the Ger Rebbe is suggesting that this notion of zechira is the part of us that is always remembered. Ulefi shebishabbat mitgale nikuda zo b'nafshot b'nei Yisrael. And since on Shabbat, our essence is what is revealed, the essence of our soul is revealed. Lachein tricha shmira. That's why we need to watch it. So the Ger Rebbe is explaining we have this dual idea of Shabbat, of zachor v'shamor. We have to watch over what is being remembered. We have to watch over our essence, which is what is always there. Even if it gets covered up, our essence is always there. Lachein tricha shmira shelo lehitpashet nekuda pinimiyut l'makom sheyesh bo shechacha. We have to make sure, we have to guard against our essence spreading out or distancing itself from us to a point where it is forgotten, where it's not recognizable. V'lachein zachor v'shamor b'dibor echad nemru. As we say, the commandment to remember and watch over were said at once, because it's very important that as soon as the zachor, our essence, is revealed, that right away we protect it. And then he explains the connection to Pesach. V'hu atzmo ha'inyan b'geulat Mitzrayim. That is the idea behind the Exodus from Egypt. Shebechol chag ha'matzot na'aseh ish Yisrael kibriyah hadasha. This is such a beautiful idea and so important for us. Every Pesach represents our rebirth. Moshe hayah b'tziat Mitzrayim kikatan shenolad. The Jewish people are born on Pesach. And he extends that idea to each individual. We are also reborn on Pesach, and we are like a Briah Chadasha. We are as a new creation, Kikatan Shenolad, like a newborn baby, like a baby that's just been born. And the very same essence that God instilled in us, that very first Yitziat Mitzrayim, that very first Pesach, is reinstilled in us every year on Pesach. Minikudazo nikre lechem oni. It's called the poor bread. Why is it poor? That's another name for matzah, by the way. Lechem oni, lechem ani, the poor bread. Shehu beli hitbrachvut. There's no additives. Ki matzahi etzem ha'isa. Matzah represents the essence of bread, because it's just the two ingredients. V'achar kach nishtanit u'mitchametzet. And later, if we let it sit and rise, it becomes chametz. V'kamo kein kol ish Yisrael. Yesh bo nikuda matana matne me'et elokim. Every single person has this essence given to them from God. U'be'emet tzaricha adam laharchiv zot ha'nikuda u'lamshich kol ha'masim l'achareha. We have to expand ourselves for sure. But v'zeh ha'tikon, when we go about our life, of course we expand beyond our essence. But comes Pesach time, and also every Shabbat, but comes Pesach time, our essence is renewed and purified. And on Pesach, we have to make sure it doesn't become chametz, it doesn't expand, and it doesn't undergo any changes. And so here you see the Gera Rebbe is teaching us that one of the essential ideas of Pesach, is the notion of returning to who we really are, of recognizing our essence. And as I said, when I first introduced this part of this topic, that's what's happening for a lot of us this year. We are focusing on some very basic things, some very basic relationships. Our preparations for Pesach are more simple and more basic. We don't want to go out as much. There may not be as much on the shelves. And this is an opportunity for us to really think about what it means to return to our essence. This comes with an immense challenge, of course, but it also brings an opportunity for us to focus and recognize what parts of our life are really essential and what part of our lives are not so essential. What part of our lives maybe have muddied the waters and they're not necessary as part of our lives. They're the leaven-like, non-essential things that we can do without. This is, of course, not to suggest that Judaism expects us to live the life of an ascetic, but it does ask us, and I think specifically in this context, to focus every once in a while. And the Alter, the Ger Rebbe, is saying it's on Shabbos and on Pesach. Focus every once in a while about what is really important in our life. And so that's one aspect of this very unique and different Pesach that we can focus on as we sit around tables, which have maybe just a few of us. We all love to have big seders, but it may be there's something nice about having a smaller seder, which will allow us to reconnect with those closest to us for some of us. So that's point number one the notion that this unique Pesach invites us to reconnect with who we really are and with what is really important. The second point I'd like to make, actually I'm going to unmute everyone. Does anyone have a comment or a question about that? Anyone have anything they'd like to add? I don't see any hands raised or anything in the chat.
Yeah. You would like to show my mouth.
So we're going to hurry on. Okay. Okay. So the next point I'd like to talk about is the notion of humility. This is somewhat related to the previous point, but there's a very interesting halacha that has nothing specifically to do with Pesach, but we can learn something from Pesach, about Pesach from it. And that is, there is a general prohibition when it comes to bringing karbanot, that our karbanot may not include chametz. I don't know if people are familiar with that. But karbanot may not include chametz. And the Ramban, Nachmanides, and this is source number 5 on the sheet, on the sources in front of you. Nachmanides, when he talks about that, he says, "V'od ra'iti peirsha Ramban." And actually, this is someone quoting the Ramban. This is the Sefer Achinuch quoting the Ramban, who says, "Shekatav kein v'zelishono uba'avur shakarbanot liratzon l'shem hanechbad." Since sacrifices are for the will of the glorious God, lo yovo min hadivarim asher lahem hayad hachazaka lishnot hativayim. They should not come from things that have a strong hand to change the nature of things. Leaven, and in this case honey as well, which is also prohibited to bring with the karbanot, but leaven changes things. And it is the human introduction of leaven that changes things, or it's the human allowance of the yeast to do its work that changes the bread. And what the Ramban is saying is that leaven represents human ingenuity and human power over the world. And the Ramban is suggesting that when it comes to the altar of God, when it comes to bringing a karban, where we are supposed to be giving ourselves to God, to God's will, that there is no place for power, there's no place for the expression of human power on God's altar. One feeling that many of us may be having this time of year is a lack of control, right? How many times have we said to each other, we don't have any idea how this is going to end? Or who could have imagined when we were all in shul on Purim that within a few days we were going to shut down our shuls and shut down our schools? We, in our wildest dreams, most of us did not think that this was going to happen. There is no doubt that Jewish tradition expects that we take control of our surroundings and harness nature to improve the world. That is what Rabbi Soloveitchik writes is the meaning of the verse in Bereshit that says, "Vayivarech otam Elokim, vayomer lahem Elokim, peru urevu umelu et haaretz v'kiv shuha." God blessed them and God said to them, "Be fertile and increase, fill the earth and master it." We are supposed to do that. There's no question about it. Yet, at a time like this, we come to recognize that even as we have done so well in fulfillment of this directive, there are events in the world that are not totally in our control. And I personally have never lived through a time where this has been more apparent than it is now. And I imagine that that is the same for many of you. This year, the prohibition of chametz on Pesach is an even stronger reminder to exercise humility, even as we work hard to understand and master the world. And again, it's very important to note that we are supposed to master the world, but we have to do it with a sense of humility, and sometimes we don't. The matzah that we eat instead of bread is called lechem oni, or lechem ani. And here there's a beautiful brief statement by Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, which is source number 6, in explaining why it's called lechem oni. He says, V'al Kain, this is source number 6 on the sources in front of you. V'al Kain, Nikret Hamatza Lechem Oni Daika, B'chinat Hachna'a V'anava. Therefore, the matzah is called Lechem Oni in the spirit of submission and humility. Oni is related in terms of the spelling, the letters, to the word anava, which is humility. This is the bread of humility. It's the bread that's supposed to teach us humility. And again, one of the lessons, the strong lessons of this Pesach in the time of Corona is our sense of humility. And that's point number 2, which I think adds a unique spiritual wrinkle to Pesach. The truth is, this idea of humility runs its course through the entire Haggadah. People like to make the comparison between the Haggadah and the Megillah, which we just read a month ago. The Megillah does not at all mention God's name, at least not overtly. It's all about Mordechai and Esther and what they did and the power that they had. The opposite is true of the Haggadah. Moshe's name is only mentioned once in passing. The rest of the Haggadah is all about God. God, God, Anivalo Malach, Anivalo Seraf, right? I am not an angel. I am not a Seraph. I did this, God says. I did this all on my own. I am in control. No one else is in control. And this year, we have a real sense of our humility. And even as we are supposed to subdue the world, having humility is obviously a very important midah, and it's something that we can focus on this year. The next idea that I think has resonance in terms of Pesach in the time of Corona is the question of reality. Our embrace of reality and recognition of just how fragile reality is. I'd like to show this to you through looking at some sources from the Haggadah and some other sources. The real question is, what is our reality? The stage is set at the very outset of the Seder for belief in a better future. The idea is reiterated at the end of the Seder. We'll get there as well. But let's look at the beginning of the Seder, at the beginning of Magid, the beginning of the Magid section of the Seder. We say as follows. Halachmanya de Achla Batana Bar de Mishrayim, Go Dichmin Yese Viejo, which we said before, we invite everyone in. And then in the bold, Hashta Hacha, Lashana Haba Ba'ara de Israel, Hashta Avde, Lashana Haba Benechorin. Now we are here, meaning in exile. Next year we'll be in the land of Israel. This year we are slaves. Next year we will be free people. Declaring at the outset of the Seder that things are not the way we want them to be, now we are here, this year we are slaves, is an invitation to admit that our world and our experience of the world is imperfect. Many of us, we sort of fake it and we pretend that everything's great. But at the beginning of the Seder, we're supposed to be celebrating our redemption. We admit, the first thing we say, is we have not been fully redeemed. Judaism in general, and the Haggadah specifically, does not ask us to sugarcoat our reality. This could be a helpful understanding of the middle section of the Amidah. We have a series of requests where we look at the world and we acknowledge that it's not perfect. All the requests that we make in the Amidah, we wouldn't be making them if we didn't need those things to be fixed. Those admissions should inspire us to do our part to fix what is broken. So we start to say they're proclaiming that our personal situation and our national situation needs repair. And this is particularly relevant this year as we yearn for our pre-isolation life. We are all waiting to get back to the pre-corona life. And the question is that a good thing? Is it a good thing to yearn for some past? Or is it better to just accept the reality and pretend that nothing's wrong? So I think it's important to recognize again, at the beginning of the Seder, we're suggesting that it's okay for us to be unsettled and unhappy with our situation. I don't know if any of you saw it this recently, but in a beautiful article that really touched me in the Atlantic, there was this article called, "Is That Nostalgia You're Feeling? Missing the Daily Pleasures of Pre-Quarantine Life Doesn't Have to Be a Bad Thing." And towards the in this article, which I have some excerpts here, there's discussion about the importance of nostalgia and the importance of recognizing that we want things to be different. You were once a person who visited your grandmother and hosted dinner parties, and you're still that person, even though you can't do those things right now. People can also feel nostalgic for things that will eventually come back, he said, citing the example of military deployment. You could be sent away and be like, well, I know I'm going to be home in 6 months or a year, but still have nostalgia for home. It's totally fine if you're missing the extremely recent past, when you could look at your friends up close and go to Dunkin' Donuts. Call it nostalgia. Call it temporary nostalgia. Call it whatever you want. It's good for you, so go ahead and soak it in a little. So this idea of admitting that we're not entirely satisfied with the way things are now, all of this points to a really important lesson that is taught at the beginning of the Seder. It's okay to miss your past life, things that you have done in the past. If it's even healthy, some suggest, because it reminds us that we will get back to it. And then this brings us to the second part of the opening statement, where we say, L'shana haba ba'aradi Yisrael, L'shana haba b'nei chorin. Next year in the land of Israel, next year we will be free people. That's source number 8. This is the ultimate statement of hope and belief in a brighter future. In the same breath that we declare our dissatisfaction and disappointment, we exclaim our trust that redemption will come. And that is a very, very important aspect of our ability to get through and maybe even to thrive during these very difficult days. Sort of the belief that we are going to be able to overcome these challenges, and the belief that this crisis is going to go away. It doesn't necessarily mean that our world is going to look exactly the way it was before, but this the ability to believe, like Shana Habab Yerushalayim, right? To believe that something's going to be different, that something's going to be better, is a very, very important Jewish characteristic. Okay, I see a hand up. Isaac B. Who is that?
That's Ike.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Ike.
I just want to question, you know, wanting to go back to the past. And I understand we all kind of want to go back to how we had it pre-corona. But as far as going back to the past, you know, wasn't that Bnei Israel's problem? Always wanting to go back to Mitzrayim. We remember the onions and the fish and all the stuff that we ate there. And a lot of examples that Moshe wants them to go forward, you know, and obviously they could not in the end. And God realized that, and he could not bring that generation forward. And there's so many examples in Midbar and stuff like that. So I want to know how you reconcile those two thoughts of going back to the past and remembering the past, but yet God always wants to do something better, I think. And so maybe
that's
the
a
way
great question.
It might be better for this, you know.
I think that's all embedded in this dual back and forth. We remember the past and we want something to be better next time. I also think that it's complicated in terms of how Bnei Israel lived, in the sense that, at least according to the Rambam, you know, God was not able to turn Bnei Israel cold turkey so far away so quickly from their past in terms of the way they worshiped, and which is why we have a Mishkan and so many other examples, because I think God even realizes that the past is a very, very powerful draw, and it's very hard for us to break from it. Now, it's not to say, Ike, you're 100% right from a Jewish perspective and from a psychological perspective, that there's unhealthy past, right? There are behaviors in our past which are unhealthy. Those are not what the Haggadah is talking about, not what I'm talking about, and not what God was talking about when he said, when he, at least again, according to the Rambam, that he wasn't going to tear them away cold turkey, even though some of those things which he sort of let linger were remnants of Avodah Zarah, right? Were remnants of idolatry, but nonetheless, he let them linger because it's very, very hard to get rid of the past. But negative past things, negative behaviors in our past, should, you know, those things we have to work very hard to get away from. Yeah. Mindy's iPhone. Who is that?
Mindy.
Okay, go ahead, Mindy.
Yeah, Rabbi, so I understand about the things about wanting to go back to the past and the great stuff we miss and the way things were. But what about all this just about not having fear altogether? I mean, it's not just about desiring what we had, but what about the feeling of being safety and how precarious life is now? I mean, it's not even just about having the great things we have. It's about just staying alive.
Yes, let's talk about safety a little bit later. Okay, that's a very good point. Okay. Okay. So we're talking now about this dance that we have between we are here now and what's going and what we're looking forward for in the future. Rabbi Soloveitchik had this beautiful idea, which he repeats many, many times in his writings, about how a Jew lives. In the brief opening section of the Haggadah, we encounter the past, present, and future. This is the bread of affliction. Now we are slaves. Next year in Jerusalem. Rabbi Soloveitchik taught, and here's I'll read you the quote in a moment, that Jewish life must be lived with a unique time awareness, wherein all three tenses are lived at the same time. And he says it in source number 9. This time awareness or experience has three basic component parts. First, retrospective. Without memory, there is no time. Second, the time experience includes exploration or close examination of things yet unborn and events not yet in existence. This means the anticipatory experience of events not yet in being. And third is the appreciation or evaluation of the present moment as one's most precious possession. So here again, Rabbi, just to underscore the point that Rabbi Soloveitchik teaches us about living in three dimensions, if you will, and finding a balance between what was, what can be, what is now, and perhaps included in that is sort of the sense of nostalgia. This concept is very apparent also in the flow of the Haggadah towards the end, which I said when it comes to Hallel. As opposed to every other time when we say Hallel, when we say one sitting, right? When we say Hallel in Shul, we say it at once, all of it at once. At the Seder, we break the Hallel up into two parts. Two psalms are recited at the end of Maggid, and the rest at the end of the Seder. I'm not sure if people pay attention to that, but this is the only time when we split Hallel into two parts. There are other distinctions. It's the only time we sit during Hallel. We don't make a bracha during this Hallel. But for our purposes tonight, we're just going to focus on the notion that Hallel is split in half. And Rabbi Soloveitchik tried to understand why it is that Hallel is split in half. And he explains the first part of Hallel represents pure praise and gratitude to God, right? It's the end of Maggid. Maggid is all about praising God, right? Avadim hayinu, we were slaves to Paro, v'yotzienu, God took us out. We sing praise to God. We say dayenu to God. We talk about the plagues, and we do all sorts of fancy mathematics to increase the number of miracles that God did for us. The beginning of the Seder is all about praise of God. And those two chapters of Tehillim, those two chapters of Psalms that we say at the end of the Maggid, of the storytelling part of the Seder, that is all about praise. But then Rabbi Soloveitchik notes that the Hallel that we say at the end of the Seder, right, which is the second to last step of the Seder, Hallel, is different. And he explains this in source number 10. We may therefore understand why the halal at the Seder was divided into two components. The element of petition was not introduced into the first part of the Haggadah. We were slaves quite a number of times, perhaps under conditions much worse than those that prevailed in Egypt. We offered up millions of sacrifices. There was much blood and much martyrdom. We forget all about this and offer only praise. That's the first half of the Seder. But not so with the subsequent chapters of Hallel at the end in the Hallel section. At the very instant we achieve the height of bliss and joyousness, we feel how unhappy and insecure we are and how much help from God. We cry out, Anna Hashem Hoshi'ana. We beseech you, God, save us. We recite not only Hallel over the fourth cup, but Hallel and Tefillah, praise and petition. It is not only a shout of joy, but also an outcry of pain. So it's reverse of what we did at the beginning of the Seder. At the beginning of the Seder, we say, this is what's wrong, and now, next year in Jerusalem. We're slaves, next year free. At the end of the Seder, with Hallel, first we focus on what's good. We praise God in Magid with two chapters of Hallel. At the end of the Haggadah, and I'll get to you now, Mindy, in a moment. At the end of the Haggadah, we get to this recognition. Well, wait a second. Right? It's not only a shout of joy, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, but also an outcry of pain. The structural patterns are dialectical. There was an inner contradiction. This is the day God made. Let us rejoice and be glad on it, is the thesis. The antithesis is, we beseech you, God, save us. So, Mindy, I think this speaks exactly to your question. And that is, and I don't know how satisfactory this is. I'm going to put your microphone on if you want to reply. This is the time of the Seder, and we maybe gloss over this all of the years when things are great, where we're saying it's okay to admit that we're scared this year. That's okay. I heard today from someone that maybe at the beginning of the Seder, we should just start out by just admitting, welcoming the elephant in the room. And so Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying, it's very interesting, right? Towards the end of the Seder, after we've spent the whole night praising God, we admit, and now we normally don't pay attention to this, but Rabbi Soloveitchik is pointing out, we admit, we have petitions. There's something's wrong, even at the height of our joyousness. And that's part of this year's different type of Seder. It's rare in our lifetime. Maybe our grandparents experienced this, but it's rare in our lifetime to have a Seder where there's some fear tied into it. And this understanding of Hallel seems to be telling us that it's okay to admit that, and we shouldn't necessarily have to pretend. Now, it's true, at the beginning of the Seder, we said, Chayav Adam Lirot Et Atzmo Ki'ilu Hu Yatzav Mitzrayim. We are obligated to see ourselves as if we left Egypt. We have to try hard to be joyous. But Rabbi Soloveitchik is giving us a little bit of a window. He's opening up a little bit for us, maybe more than a little bit, to recognize that it's hard. So you've touched on something very true and very human, and I think it doesn't pay, and we don't even have to pretend it's not there. So before I get to Amy Goldstein's question, I'll just wrap up this point that the Haggadah is a reality check, and it doesn't expect us to accept or to focus only on one reality. That's why I said, what is the reality? I don't know, last year the reality was everything's great in the world. And this year the reality is everything's not so great in the world. And both of those are in the Seder. Now, Hashata Avde, now we're slaves. Next year in Jerusalem, we spend all of Magid singing God's praises like everything's great. But then we end the Magid, we end the Seder with requests and beseeching God. The Haggadah is an invitation for us to be real with our feelings. Hopefully, next year we'll be back to forgetting about the petitionary aspect of the Seder, but it's certainly there and gives us that invitation. Okay, go ahead, Amy.
Thank you, Rabbi. This has been very enlightening. I just wanted to say that on that last point, Erev Pesach has always been a very dangerous time historically for Jews, and not just in recent events, but that's one of the reasons we have Eliyahu Hanavi come. It's the hope for redemption, but it's also because it is a time when we are in the greatest weakness. And there are all these stories, Yiddish stories, where pogroms happen on Leil HaSeder. Rabbis get killed, rabbis' families get killed, they find a dead Christian boy under their table, all sorts of things. And so we've been very lucky in the recent past here in America, but traditionally, certainly before America and before the State of Israel, this was a very nervous time for the Jewish people.
Excellent.
So maybe we get back to that feeling and in touch with our ancestors of a little bit more than the recent past. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. That's a very, very touching insight. Thank you, Amy. And so finally, I'd like to focus on this question of and leave us with an uplifting message. And that is, I think, that one of the messages of the Haggadah or Pesach is the message of purpose and meaning. And I'd like to start by looking at a question that's based on the first time the idea of the exile in Egypt is mentioned, all the way back in the time of Abraham, in the Brit Ben Abitarim, when God tells Abraham that his descendants are going to be enslaved in Israel, in Egypt. Vayomer l'Avram, this is source number 12. Yadoa teda. By the way, I'll just add one other thing to Amy's point and Mindy's point. The end of almost the end of the Seder is the Hallel of petition, where we recognize fear. But what's the actual last thing we say at the Seder? L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim. We always, even in our fear, we have faith that we're going to be able to overcome. So again, it's this sort of roller coaster of emotions that we're invited to feel at the Seder. Okay, so now, the last point. God tells Abraham that his descendants are going to serve time in Egypt. Vayomer la'Avram, yadoa teda ki ger yazaracha be'eretz lo lahem, v'avadum v'inuotam arba'a meot shana. Know well that your offspring will be strangers in the land, not theirs, and they shall be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. So Rabbi Mirsky, a Yehuda Mirsky, who was my teacher, Yitzchak Mirsky, who was my teacher in yeshiva and BMT a long time ago, wrote a wonderful Haggadah. And in this Haggadah, he asked a fascinating question. He said, this is called the Brit Ben Abitarim, the covenant of the pieces. Normally, when you enter into a covenant with someone, it's the win-win, right? We negotiate and everyone walks away feeling that they got something that they wanted. Here, Avraham gives his fidelity to God. And what does Avraham get in return? A promise that his descendants are going to be enslaved in Egypt, in a faraway land, in a land not theirs. It doesn't seem very covenantal. It doesn't seem at all like it's a win-win for Avraham. What on earth is going on here? So Rabbi Mirsky turns our attention to a fascinating statement by the Maharal of Prague. This is also a theme which the Maharal of Prague comes back to often. And his approach is simple. Let's read it inside and then we'll explain it. It's source number 13. It's an interesting source. I shouldn't say simple. It's interesting. And I think it could be a little bit controversial and also misunderstood. So let's see how we do with it. So the Maharal says in source number 13, Kvar hitpa'er lecha ki galut Yisrael im shehu chisaron mitzad atzmo li Yisrael. He first says, let's just make it clear, I've said this before, says the Maharal, the exile of the Jews in Egypt was in and of itself bad. It was a chisaron. It was something which was lacking. It was a negative thing. So we have to be clear that the Maharal is making his first point, that the exile, the slavery in Egypt, was a bad thing. But husiba el hatov hamikaveh lanu libesof. It leads to, or is the reason for, now he doesn't mean reason the way, like cause and effect. It leads to the good that was hoped for in the end. V'im ki'ein hagalut siba l'tov hamikaveh ve'etzem. It's not, says the Maharal, that the exile is the direct causal reason for something that good that happened at the end. Husiba mikol makom l'tov. But nonetheless, it leads and led to the good. Kikol havaya yukdam lo he'ader. Then he makes his general point. Everything positive, everything that exists is preempted by something that is lacking. Moshe bi'arnu kama pamim. So he's the Maharal here is making a general point about the way the world works. This is a cosmic point the Maharal is making. That if you look at the world, good things come in the wake of bad things. Kemoshe yukdam halayla lefnei hayom. He says, first comes dark, then comes the light. V'kach yukdam olam hazeh lefnei olam haba. First we have this world, which is full of its trials and tribulations, and then comes olam haba, the next world. V'kach ra'oy sheyukdam lefnei zeh ha'eder v'chisaron hu agalut. He says, the Maharal is trying to answer another question. He's trying to say, why did we need the exile in Egypt? What was the point? Right? Why do we need the Jews to suffer for so many years? So he's trying to thread the needle. He's trying to say that there was some sort of development that happened during that time, which in the end contributed to the freedom and the development of Bnei Yisrael. And he suggests that that's the way the world works. And there's a Gemara, an interesting Gemara, that mentions this idea. Gemara, the Talmud Bavli, source number 14, of Al Gabe Beitza, Emat Gadla, L'chi Misricha. With regards to a chick that emerges from an egg, one can say, when does the chick grow out of and emerge from the egg? It does so when the egg rots. The chick is only comes just, there's a very fine line between when the chick develops in the egg, and if not, the egg is going to turn bad. But as the egg is turning bad, that's when the chick develops, says the Gemara, and a new life is born. The Maharal of Prague's approach is that, again, the period of exile was in and of itself bad for the Jews. It was also, he notes, it contributed to the good that came after. Of course, we do not seek out negative experiences in the hope or even belief that something positive will come, but sometimes that is the case. Again, we don't understand or pretend to understand why bad things happen in the world. The workings of the world are mysterious. But the Maharal teaches us a crucial lesson. It's often from really hard times that positive things emerge. It is this mindset. So the question for us is, can we embrace this mindset? Right? Are we able to sort of switch gears and say, this is bad. In and of itself, this is bad. Nobody wants this, and nobody would say, well, I'll take it because something good may come out of it. We're not supposed to live that way. But now that it's here, right, are we able to imagine what positive things may come out of it, even as we are apart? So here are a couple of thoughts that came to my mind in this regard. Even as we are apart, in some ways, our communities have never been stronger. We have witnessed wide-range concern for each other's well-being. New creative ways to reach out to people have been employed. We have seen improvements in how we use technology to connect to one another. The realization that we miss each other has certainly been heightened. We may be able to turn the switch and find something positive in this, the way the Maharal is suggesting. And again, not that we wanted the exile from Egypt, not that we wanted this pandemic, but now that it is here, are we able to recognize that we if we decide this, right, we can perhaps gain something, and certainly there's a lot that we can learn from it. Someone who popularized this idea is Viktor Frankl, who is the founder of logotherapy, which is a psychotherapeutic approach that focuses on the search for meaning in human existence. And I don't know if you know this, but Viktor Frankl essentially developed this idea in the concentration camps when he was a concentration camp inmate. And he wrote as follows in source number 15. What was really needed was a fundamental change in our attitude toward life. We had to learn ourselves, and furthermore, we had to teach the despairing men that it did not really matter what we expected from life, but rather what life expected from us. We needed to stop asking about the meaning of life and instead to think of ourselves as those who are being questioned by life daily and hourly. Our answer must consist not in talk and meditation, but in right action and in right conduct. Life ultimately means taking the responsibility to find the right answer to its problems and to fulfill the tasks which is constantly set for each individual. How we emerge from this situation is very much a function of whether or not we can find purpose in it. No doubt that the world will be different when this is all over. The question for us is, how will I or how will we be different? I'm fond of the story told about Rabbi Baruch Ber Leibowitz. When he was a boy, after misbehaving, his parents scolded him and he started to cry. Shortly thereafter, his parents noticed that he was davening mincha. After he finished davening, his parents asked him why he started davening while in the midst of crying. And he replied, "Since I was crying, I figured I would daven mincha. Why should I waste a good cry?" And I think that that is the message. We are all crying. We should not waste it. We should not waste this moment. We should think about how it's changed us. I feel like we are in a moment like that now. Once we get accustomed to all the changes, we should make sure not to let this moment pass without thinking about how we are different, how we should look at the world differently. We discussed some of those things at the beginning of our discussion tonight. The issue of humility. This certainly has given us a greater sense of humility. The notion of getting back to basics, as represented by the simple matzah. Those all may be a result, if we all think carefully and deeply about what's going on, those may be a result of thoughtful thinking about the situation. And I reiterate, we didn't want this situation, but the results can have some positive meaning depending on how we take them. Our challenge is to learn to engage in the long game. So I will close here with a quote from Rabbi Soloveitchik. It reminds us of the importance of continuing to look for meaning and purpose and grabbing it when it comes. And there are not that many moments in life when we're sort of shaken to recognize that we are in a very, very different time. And I truly believe that this is one of those times. And the question is, are we going to embrace the challenge? And this is Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote, "The Jew has taught me how to wait," so wrote the famous playwright Henrik Ibsen, a Gentile and a very sensitive person. This is the greatness of our people. Waiting is the art the Jew knows best. No other nation knows how to wait like the Jew. Next year in Jerusalem. This year we are here. Next year in the land of Israel. This year we are slaves. Next year, free men. This is the characteristic trait of the Jew. The Messiah is a little slow in coming. Nevertheless, we are still waiting. If he knocks on our door, we will open it for him. I'm not suggesting at all that this is the messianic time. Let me rephrase that. This may be the messianic time. I'm not suggesting that Corona is a sign that we are in the messianic time. What I am suggesting is, conceptually, there are moments in our life when God is asking us to open the door. There are moments in our life when we are in control of how we are going to view things in our lives, and moments where that really makes a huge difference. And we are in one of those times. We are in one of those times now. We are in one of those Baruch Ber Leibowitz times where we should not waste a good cry, and we should do our best to take control. It doesn't mean we're not afraid, Mindy. It doesn't mean, Ike, that everything in the past was great. It means that with the fear and with the recognition of what was good in the past, what was not with the past, we embrace this moment, and we recognize that Jewish reality is always a balancing act, but we have the opportunity how to react to that very, very delicate balance, which is Jewish life. I see a question here from Shira Sassone. Go ahead, Shira.
Hi there. Thank you so much for this. Before you end, I just wanted to ask, I see this is being recorded, and I was wondering how I could access it after it's over.
I'm going to put it on my YouTube channel. So that's one way. I'll also probably send it out tomorrow. Or if you email me, I'll just send you a link. So lots
okay,
of different
thank
ways.
You so much.
It'll also be, I think it's on Facebook Live. So if you go to my Facebook page, it'll also be there. I think it's
okay, thank
on
you.
Facebook Live. Let me, oh, actually, I don't know if it went to Facebook Live. Okay, so my dear friends, this is the call of the hour, right? The question of how we react is very much in our power, while recognizing the reality of the situation that we are in. So just to very, very quickly review, Pesach in the age of Corona is a time for us to tap in to and to recognize and to feel humble and humbled. Pesach in the time of Corona is an opportunity to get back to basics, like the matzah is the most basic of foods. Pesach in the time of Corona is an opportunity for us to recognize that the Jewish reality is always going back and forth between Hashata Avdei L'Shana Haba B'nei Chorin. Now we are slaves, next year we will be free. It's always a balance between celebrating the Maggid section and the two chapters of the Hallel that are all praise of God, and the end of the Haggadah of Hallel, where we ask God to change things and we make petitions of God, recognizing that things aren't great. And the way that we as Jews are supposed to contend with this is by finding purpose, is by trying to find the inner strength to lead ourselves, to govern ourselves, to understand the time, the question of the day, what is being asked, what is being asked of us. And as Rabbi Soloveitchik said, when a moment of inspiration, or in his case, redemption, he suggested, comes, open the door and embrace the opportunity to empower ourselves to find meaning in every situation that we are in. And with that, I wish you all a chag kosher v'sameach. May you all have a joyous and kosher Pesach. It be a Pesach which is one of health for all of us. And even as we are not celebrating Pesach the way we would have really liked to, I hope we could still find meaning in this Pesach, whether we're celebrating with a Seder on our own, with one other person, with a few other people. Find joy and find something to be grateful for in any situation that you are in. If anyone has any questions or any last-minute needs before Pesach, of course, do not hesitate to call on me, and I really, really hope to see you soon. I'm going to end my Seder with Lashana Haba Yerushalayim and with Bishavua Haba Beit Knesset. Hopefully that will get God's ear. But if not, we'll just keep taking care of each other and davening for this to come to an end. Chag Kasher v'Sameach, everyone. Thank you for joining.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Mute yourself.